Russia has warned that it's ready to sever ties with the European Union if the bloc hits Moscow with new economic sanctions. The EU reportedly plans to impose travel bans and asset freezes on allies of the Russian president in response to the last week's expulsion of German, Polish, and Swedish diplomats from Moscow. Tensions have risen recently over the arrest of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Moscow says the West is exploiting Navalny's case for political reasons. The latest differences between Moscow and the EU could put pressure on the Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline being built from Russia to Germany. The United States has also imposed sanctions on companies working on the project. Once completed, Nord Stream 2 would double the flow of energy resources between Russia and Germany.
Russia and the EU have remained at odds over a host of issues for years. Tensions, however, between the two have escalated recently over the alleged poisoning of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny and his ensuing imprisonment for violating a parole. Navalny's arrest upon his return from Germany sparked angry reactions in Europe and at home, with thousands of his supporters taking to the streets across Russia. Moscow slammed the rallies as illegal and expelled three European diplomats for attending the rallies. Russia says Navalny's case is an internal affair and that it won't allow any foreign interference in it. However, Russia's move prompted tit-for-tat expulsions from Germany, Poland, and Sweden. And the EU foreign policy chief has called for a new round of sanctions on Russia.
First, we will discuss this issue at the Foreign Affairs Council on the next 22nd of February, at the European Union Council in March. This will provide guidance on the way forward, and it will be for the member states to decide the next step. But yes, this could include sanctions.
Russia has reacted strongly to the EU's call, saying it is ready to sever ties with the bloc if it goes ahead with its economic sanctions plan. The Kremlin says it doesn't want to isolate itself, but it has to be ready for the worst-case scenario.
We assume that we are ready to sever ties in case we see again, as we have felt more already, that sanctions create risks for our economy are imposed in most vulnerable areas. Yes, if you want peace, prepare for war.
The Navalny case is just a tip of the iceberg in sinking relations between Moscow and Brussels. Among other things, they have been widely at odds over Russia's support for anti-government forces in eastern Ukraine and reunification of the strategic Black Sea peninsula of Crimea with Russia. Several European countries and the United States have accused Russia of blocking any solution to the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Russia, however, blames Ukraine for failing to implement the 2015 Minsk Agreement that was aimed at putting an end to the conflict. It seems that a current diplomatic spat could be counterproductive for both Russia and Europe, as the two need each other for trade, particularly natural gas. Moscow is building a new pipeline that would bring gas to several European countries, undercutting Ukraine as a transit country. As expected, the U.S. is opposed to the project, claiming it will increase the bloc's energy reliance on Russia. Washington has imposed several rounds of sanctions on the companies involved in the construction of the project. Germany, which has always resisted a direct confrontation with Russia, has fought hard to keep the pipeline going, saying it is a commercial, not a political issue. Despite increasing tensions between the EU and Russia, many European leaders have already signaled they are not quite interested to see a deepening of a standoff with Moscow. It remains to be seen if tensions could spiral out of control as the new US administration and some of its European allies seem hell-bent on declaring Russia as a major challenge.
Well, joining us on this debate, we have historian, journalist, and author Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos, who's with us from the British capital, London. Also, we have research fellow at American University in Moscow, Gilbert Doctorow, joining us from Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Dr. Papadopoulos. Strong words from the Russian foreign minister, who says that Moscow should be prepared for the worst. Now, just recently, Sergei Lavrov said that the EU is not a reliable partner, at least at the current stage. Where is this heading? In your opinion, is this a new low for Russia-EU ties?
Well, when Britain departed from the European Union, there was a chance, albeit a slim one, that relations between the EU and Russia could improve. Why? Because when Britain had been a member of the EU, the British had constantly pressurized Germany and France, which are the engines of the European Union, to adopt a severe stance on Russia. in plain terms, we can say that when Britain had been a member of the European Union, the British were lobbying very hard on behalf of American objectives in the EU. Now, since Britain has left the EU, the decisions of the European Union vis-a-vis Russia have hardly been conducive to improving relations between Brussels and Moscow. And indeed, the focal point at the moment concerns the EU's stance, completely unreasonable, unsubstantiated stance on Alexei Navalny. Now, we have to ask, why is that? The European Union, as it stands today, is at its most fragile, politically and economically. And it is certainly not in the interests of the overwhelming majority of EU member states, with the notable exception, of course, of Poland and the Baltic states, for relations between the economic bloc and the Russian Federation to deteriorate even further. However, it certainly is in the interests of the Americans and the British for relations between the EU and Russia to deteriorate even further. Ultimately, the European Union is a strategic ally to America. The European Union coordinates its foreign policy and its defense policy with America, so much so that we can argue persuasively that America is the outside dominant force in the European Union. So it is, in my estimation, that the Americans and the British have exploited the incident concerning Alexei Navalny to bring about a further worsening of relations between the European Union and Russia, because Washington and London do not want an improvement in relations between the EU and Russia.
Right. Let's cross over to Brussels now, Mr. Doug Taro. Last week, EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell said that his meeting with the foreign minister Lavrov highlighted that Europe and Russia are drifting apart, and that it seems that Russia is progressively disconnecting itself from Europe. Do you think that there's any place for constructive dialogue at the current moment right now?
I think what's needed is shock therapy. And this is exactly what Lavrov's words were meant to do yesterday. Just let's keep in mind that Mr. Lavrov is a very capable and very seasoned diplomat at global level. At the same time, the direction of his actions, the directions of his words, are given by Mr. Putin. And behind his remarks about preparing for war, if you want to have peace, we can see very clearly the thinking and the direction of Vladimir Putin. The point here is that Russia and the EU have been drifting apart for the last 10 years. Going back to 2012, when the European Union declined to renew its overall cooperation and strategic partnership with Russia, there has been a downward movement. It's lurched at various points. Of course, the 2014 events in Crimea and the Ukrainian civil war were one important turning point, or I should say lurch, backwards in the relationship. But there have been others. The Skripal poisoning was one. The MH17 was one. And they all have something in common. And that something in common, and here's why I differ a bit with the previous speaker, is a script written in Washington. If the UK has been the voice of skepticism, if not hostility to Russia within the EU, that was all acting in a nod and a wink with what it was receiving by way of recommendations from Washington. The Poland and the Baltic states are the cat's paw of the United States within the EU, and they are effective precisely because the way it is structured today, the EU cannot have a foreign policy that is worth anything. Everything must be based on consensus. Any naysayer can destroy that consensus and deprive the EU of a policy. We are in a situation where these Baltic states and Poland are depriving the major powers in Europe of logical, reasonable relations with Russia. At the same time, Mrs. Merkel is not an innocent bystander in this. Germany has had its own very clear interests as a major power in Mitteleuropa, as where German industry is heavily installed ever since these countries became free of the East Bloc. And Germany is in a love affair with these countries and does not find it very simpatico, very easy to deal with Russia. Russia is too big, Russia is too strong. And so it is very easy for Mrs. Merkel and her party and Germany to stand aside and let the Poles and the Baltics do all the nasty words about Russia and appear to be calm and reasonable. Germany is not being calm and reasonable. Its present policy of encouraging Mr. Navalny, of giving him all support when he made his fake news video during his stay in Germany, this is not the act of a friendly power or even a neutral power. It's the act of a hostile power.
Okay.
So Germany has also become an active contributor to the deterioration in relations with Russia.
Back to London, Dr. Papadopoulos. Following the expulsion of the three European diplomats, the EU has hinted at imposing new sanctions against Moscow. Of course, that's a decision that needs to be approved by European governments. How do you view that approach from Brussels?
Well, I believe that that threat from the European Union actually originates in Washington. Because as I said moments ago, the European Union, even before what is known as COVID-19, was in a economically precarious condition. And relations with Russia, trade relations, investment relations, are very important to the European Union. It is simply not conducive to the economic well-being of the European Union for there to be EU sanctions on Russia, which stem from 2014, when the European Union, in tandem with America and Britain, initiated and implemented a coup against the then Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych. And as a result of the EU sanctions on the Russian Federation, many jobs and companies in the European Union, for example in Spain and Italy and Greece, have been seriously jeopardized because they're no longer able to export to the European Union. So if we speed forward to 2021, how on earth is it in the interest for ordinary people, ordinary companies in the European Union, for the EU to place further sanctions on Russia? Because that will mean that agricultural companies in the EU will be even more impeded in their ability to export to the European Union. So that is why my submission is that behind the EU's threat stands America and also Britain. Of course, Poland and the Baltic states are enjoying the deterioration in relations between Brussels and Moscow because the Baltic states and Poland are vehemently anti-Russian and are doing all within their means to act as a conduit for Western aggression against Russia. Let us not forget that last summer, when the West attempted to engineer a coup in Belarusia, or Belarus as it is officially known as, Poland and the Baltic states acted as the logistical countries in that attempted coup. So the European Union is not truly an independent or sovereign economic bloc. Ultimately, it bends to the will of the Americans.
Same question to Gilbert Dottaro. Have European sanctions been working on Russia?
Well, let's be very clear, because this has not come out in the discussion until now. Mr. Lavrov's statement was explicit. He was not speaking about just any sanctions. He was speaking about sanctions that threaten the vital economic interests of Russia. Now, what does that mean? We don't have to guess. There are two sanctions which could threaten the economic well-being of Russia, and they are first pulling the plug on SWIFT, kicking Russia out of SWIFT, the International Settlement Organization for financial transactions, and the second is putting a halt if not to permanently stopping the Nord Stream 2 project. The Nord Stream 2 project is the lesser of these two threats to Russia, but it's also very significant. And I'd like to make a small correction to the remarks at the introduction to this program. Because the Nord Stream 2 pipeline is not going to give additional gas to Europe. It will replace pipelines which have been through Ukraine, which are a means for the United States to threaten a European gas supplies and Russian ability to deliver gas at any moment. So it is providing the Nord Stream 2 would provide a reliable transit of gas to Europe. But coming back to SWIFT, that would be a deadly threat to the Russian economy and in Iran. You certainly know what this means. Unlike Iran, which did not have the capability of doing damage to those who were imposing the sanctions on it, since petroleum is not as vital or as limited in its supply and in its transport as gas is, Iran did not have a leverage that the Russians have. If the Europe were to implement what was called 2 years ago the nuclear option, that is, throwing Russia out of SWIFT and doing vast damage to the Russian economy, the Russians could do vast damage to the European economy on 2 minutes' notice by stopping the shipment of all gas to Western Europe. If they did that in the middle of Europe, in the middle of the European winter, then all hell would break loose here. So I think that by speaking as he did yesterday about cutting relations, what exactly does that mean? Does it just mean throwing out diplomats, or does it mean really cutting relations? Gas is the single most important element in European-Russian relations, and it would be entirely logical that the Russians would have their finger on that button if the SWIFT cutoff were cut to come to the fore in the European Parliament.
Dr. Papadopoulos, we're talking about the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. Despite the souring of ties with the Kremlin, Germany is going ahead with the Nord Stream 2 project. On the issue, the German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier said, quote, energy ties are almost the last bridge between Russia and Europe. The foreign minister, German foreign minister Heiko Maas, also said we must not burn all bridges with Russia. Supporters of this pipeline say that it's an economic project, not a political one, and it shouldn't be used as leverage. What is your perspective on the issue?
Indeed. And therein lies the reason, the ultimate reason, as to why a severing in economic relations between the European Union and the Russian Federation is highly unlikely. On the other hand, a severing in political relations between Brussels and Moscow is possible, but I believe it is inconceivable that there would be a severing in relations between an economic severing in relations between the European Union and Russia. Why? Because Russia needs the European market, and in particular the German market, to export its natural gas too. That is absolutely critical to the Russian economy. And likewise, the vast amounts, the vast majority of the European Union's natural gas comes from Russia. And when it comes to Germany, Germany is heavily dependent on the Russian Federation for natural gas. If Russia turned off its gas supply to the European Union, then the European economy, and the German economy in particular, would almost collapse overnight. And how would ordinary Germans and Europeans be able to survive the autumn and winter months? How would they be able to keep warm in their homes when there is no longer Russian natural gas coming into the European Union? So Sergei Lavrov, who is not a member of Putin's inner circle, he is a messenger, albeit a very capable one, has issued an exceptionally stern warning to the European Union to refrain from issuing those two sanctions on Russia. And I believe that the Europeans and ultimately the Americans understand that if Russia he did go ahead and sever all relations, political, but most important of all, economic, then the European Union would simply collapse. Where would Europe receive its gas from? How would European industry be able to function without Russian natural gas? So it is not in the interest for Russia to sever economic relations, and likewise, it is not in the interest for the European Union to no longer be in receipt of Russian natural gas.
Mr. Dottaro, following up on what our guest in London just said, is Germany basically making Europe more dependent on Russia?
Well, as I said, it's confusing the issue to speak about Nord Stream 2 as raising Russian supplies of gas to Europe. It's raising Russian supplies of gas directly to Germany, that's correct. But it does not change the balance of Russian's contribution to the Europe-wide energy situation. It is simply removing Russian gas, or half of Russian gas supplied to Europe, from the fragile, politically vulnerable pipelines through Ukraine. It is in the interests of Russia to continue this, and the only purpose of Lavrov's warning was to remind them that Russia is not an insignificant country, is a major power, and must be treated with respect. It also was a reminder that the Russians take a very dim view of the whole Navalny promotion coming out of Europe. I think that we have to remember that within Russia's power structures, within Russia's political elites, and not just Mr. Putin and his narrow circle, but within the whole Russian power structure, there is a feeling of relief that Mr. Navalny finally has been treated as he should have been treated 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay.
There is the feeling that in trying to appear reasonable and civilized and decent and law and respecting human rights, the Kremlin has given the wrong signals to the West.
All right, I'm going to have to jump in there.
Confused.
Apologies, so we're running short of time. Thanks to my guest, historian, journalist, and author, Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos, joining us from London. Also thanks to research fellow at American University in Moscow, Mr. Gilbert Dottaro, joining us from Brussels. Also special thanks to you for joining us on this debate. It's goodbye for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Madarsi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَإِذَا تُتْلَى عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتُنَا بَيِّنَاتٍ تَعْرِفُ فِي وُجُوهِ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا الْمُنكَرَ يَكَادُونَ يَسْطُونَ بِالَّذِينَ يَتْلُونَ عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتِنَا قُلْ أَفَأُنَبِّئُكُمْ بِشَرٍّ
النار وعدها الله الذين كفروا وبئس المصير.
And when our verses are recited to them as clear evidences, you recognize in the faces of those who disbelieve disapproval. They are almost on the verge of assaulting those who recite to them our verses. Say, then shall I inform you of what is worse than that? It is the fire which Allah has promised those who disbelieve, and wretched is the destination.
The 72nd verse of the chapter, it says, وَإِذَا تُتْلَى عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتُنَا بَيِّنَاتٍ تَعْرِفُ فِي وُجُوهِ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا الْمُنْكَرِ. And when our clear signs are recited unto them, you recognize repugnance in the faces of those who disbelieve. يَكَادُونَ يَسْطُونَ بِالَّذِينَ يَتْلُونَ عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتِنَا. So that well nigh they shall rush upon those who recite to them our signs. قُلْ أَفَأُنَبِّئُكُمْ بِشَرٍ مِّن ذَلِكُمْ أَنَّارُ وَعَدَهَا اللَّهُ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا وَبِئْسَ الْمَصِيرُ. Say, shall I inform you of what is worse than this? The fire Allah has promised it to those who disbelieve, and an evil destination it is. Through this holy verse, in a short sentence, the intensity, obstinacy, and bigotry of the idolaters against the verses of Allah have been referred to. It says, وَإِذَا تُتْلَى عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتُنَا بَيِّنَاتٍ. And when our clear signs are recited unto them, تَعْرِفُ فِي وُجُوهِ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا الْمُنْكَرُ. You recognize repugnance in the faces of those who disbelieve. Al-munkar in this verse means the feeling of somehow dislike and disgust with regard to anything. And here, munkar is translated into repugnance. So, in fact, when hearing these clear verses, the understanding of which is really simple for any intellectual, there appears a contrast between the lively logic of the Holy Quran and the ignorant bigotries of the disbelievers. And since they're not ready to accept this fact and truth, involuntarily its signs are recognized in their faces, and these signs are seen in the form of rejection and repugnance. Their manner is so that not only the effect of inconvenience and repugnance is seen in their features, but also as the result of their immense bigotry and obstinacy, they are about to stand and attack those who recite these divine verses unto them. The verse continues, يَكَادُونَ يَسْطُونَ بِالَّذِينَ يَتْلُونَ عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتِنَا. The Arabic word يَسْطُونَ is derived from satwan, which means to lift one's hand to rush against the opposite party. As Raghib cites in his Mufradat, it originally means the rays of a horse on its feet and lifting its hands. And then, after that, it has been used in this meaning to lift your hand to attack someone.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
With regard to this part of the verse, if a person thinks logically, which habitually does, when he hears a wrong statement, he will neither frown nor does he answer it with tight fist. And on the contrary, he may honestly reject it with its logical statements. These wrong reactions of the disbelievers are themselves as clear evidences that show that they follow no reason, they have no logic, and only ignorance and bigotry dominate them. Their entities are dominated by obstinacy. And one interesting point regarding the verse is that in conflicts between paganism and faith, pagans usually concentrate their harsh invasions upon the spiritual and cultural centers and personalities. They sometimes take the temples and centers of worship as their target, which you may remember, dear listeners, it was referred to. I assume it was the 40th verse of the current surah, where it says, الَّذِينَ أُخْرِجُوا مِنْ دِيَارِهِمْ بِغَيْرِ حَقٍّ إِلَّا أَنْ يَقُولُوا رَبُّنَا اللَّهُ وَلَوْلَا دَفْعُ اللَّهِ النَّاسَ بَعْضَهُمْ بِبَعْضٍ لَهُدِّمَتْ صَوَامِعُ وَبِيَعٍ. Certainly, there would have been pulled down cloisters and churches. Sometimes, they attack the preachers of the religion or their audience. Just the same concept as this verse is referring to. يَكَادُونَ يَسْطُونَ الَّذِينَ يَتْلُونَ عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتِنَا. They are about to rush upon those who recite to them our signs. We will, inshallah, continue talking about this holy verse in the next program. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry, in your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website, at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me. Why ends when fate begins?
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. The World with Reporters.
These kind of actions calling for the boycott of Israeli products will not be possible anymore if the French Minister of Justice, Dupont Moretti, succeeds in his intentions. In a letter, he instructed all prosecutors, magistrates, and judges in France to condemn appeals to boycott Israeli products because it is a discrimination against the nation, he says. But an important group of French people reacted publicly, stating that BDS is legitimate and legal. In June last year, the European Court for Human Rights said that boycott is a legal political weapon. Pierre Stamboul is member of the board of the French Jewish Union for Peace and a BDS activist. His father was deported by the Nazis.
In France and in the USA, many Jews are involved in the BDS movement because Israel and the Zionist movement commit crimes against the Palestinians. The Israeli policy is an insult to our memory, our history, and our identity. Today we see that France is again complicit with Israel, but nevertheless, France has been condemned by the European Court of Human Rights to pay 100,000 euros to BDS activists who organized the boycott action.
For lawyer Dominique Cochin, the judgment of the European Court prevails over the French directives.
That means that France is committed to respect the judgments of the European Court of Human Rights. Minister Moretti pretends to obey this judgment. It says in Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights that the boycott is a totally legitimate political way of expression. But the French Minister of Justice, with this letter, tries again to criminalize the appeal to boycott.
The appeal to BDS has been launched by the Palestinians in 2005 and had a support all over the world, with remarkable events also in France, with actions in supermarkets or boat protests against the inauguration of a Ben-Gurion square. They asked the end of the colonization and occupation of Palestine. The French Minister of Justice would like BDS activists to appear in courthouses to be condemned for criticizing Israel. That will not be easy because most lawsuits against BDS are won by the activists till now. Chris Denhant, Paris.
The clashes between the police and the government employees in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. The security forces use excessive tear gas to prevent opposition-backed protesters who government fears could have besieged country's parliament. They demanded the government to raise their salaries by 40% to compensate them over massive price hike and inflation after Pakistan devalued its currency under an intense IMF pressure.
Tear gas and the lathi charge, that is really shameful because we are not terrorists. Our salaries should be increased, should be competitive because when Imran Khan government took charge, inflation rate, you can see 300% inflation rate has been high and increased during the previous 2.5 years. And we are still, the PTI government has not increased even 1% our salaries in the last budget.
The protests by the government employees disrupted the usual official business across the country at a time when the mainstream opposition parties joined hands against Prime Minister Imran Khan's government to oust him from power over alleged rigging in 2018's general elections.
We condemn the brutal violence in government employees. It is incredible to see such excessive use of force against the government employees. If they do not work in their offices, the government business would come to a grinding half. Will Imran Khan alone run the government?
Fearing the politicization of the protest, a better sense prevailed and Prime Minister Imran Khan's government apologized with the protesting employees of the government and finally successfully negotiated with the leaders of the employees' union to end their protest. The government has announced to increase a 25% raise in their salaries. The troubles for the government are far from over. The mainstream opposition parties are all set to start a long march from all over Pakistan to capital Islamabad next month. However, with the end of the protest of employees, the government has managed to contain the crisis from being aggravated ahead of a long march. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The 7th so-called Ukraine Association Council meeting has just taken place in Brussels. The delegation that travelled from Kiev used the opportunity to encourage the EU to ramp up its sanctions against Moscow.
We hope that the deep sanctions regime for violations of human rights would allow for the enhancement of the sanctions list and the expansion of the sanctions list of the European Union.
Russia denies claims it is trying to destabilize Ukraine and asserts its right to protect what it sees as legitimate regional interests. Just like several other nations surrounding Russia, the EU would like Ukraine to join its 27-nation bloc.
The European Union has already provided significant overall financial assistance to Ukraine. We are talking about 16 billion euros since 2014.
The EU regularly reminds us of its values, but critics say the bloc is often willing to look the other way in pursuit of its ambitions to further expand and to isolate Russia. After all, Ukraine is consistently ranked one of the most corrupt countries in the world. The EU needs Russia. The European Commission's own website says two-thirds of the EU's oil imports come from Russia, as do three-quarters of its gas imports. A new pipeline from Russia to Germany, which is 90% complete, is set to double the EU's gas imports. We don't need a new Cold War, many argue.
As a Russian speaker living in the European Union, and not me only, but 6 million we are all over, we want good relations. We don't want war.
Earlier this week, EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell attracted scathing criticism in the European Parliament.
High Representative Borrell, you should resign.
This was for going ahead with an official visit to Moscow last week. However, some legislators expressed an alternative view.
This isn't about human rights. This is a geopolitical agenda against Russia, fueled by a military-industrial complex who need an enemy to justify their millions.
If that is true, as citizens, most of us clearly underestimate the power of the arms industry. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
As the nation's media and political elite are consumed by the impeachment trial of ex-President Donald Trump, talks on a desperately needed and long-delayed major economic stimulus package have been forced on hold. After an economically devastating pandemic year, Main Street has been clamoring for economic aid. President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion relief bill has a huge 75% public approval rating. But as Democrats issue more of the exact details, fissures are mounting between their left and right factions. Republicans who want to reduce the stimulus package are being accused of defying public opinion. Discontent is also rising as Biden's proposal backtracks, pulls his support, or reduces a host of economic promises, ending Trump's signature tax cuts for the rich, student debt relief, the amount of and length of unemployment payments, the total amount of household stimulus checks, and all while many say Main Street needed all of that and more in the world's richest country.
If we're not talking about $2,000 per month with retro pay and also a forgiveness of all mortgages as well as rent. And I don't mean like moratorium where they have to pay it down the line. If you couldn't pay $1,000 a month, then you're not going to be able to pay $5,000 over the course of 5 months to do it. That's just asinine.
There is mounting backlash over Biden's plan to abandon the proposed raising of the minimum wage from $7 to $15 an hour. Such an increase wouldn't just reverse decades of soaring wage inequality. It would spur much-needed economic growth amid the pandemic recession. The federal minimum wage has not been lifted in over a decade, further impoverishing the nation's working poor and lower classes. The gap between campaign promises and what looks like will actually be delivered may explain why a top poll recently showed that 70% of the nation is dissatisfied with, quote, the way things are going in the nation today.
Capitalism needs this to be put on pause. Actually, I mean, you know, my opinion, capitalism needs to be replaced, but capitalism needs to be on pause from the banks on down. And the reality is, if these measures are not done, these drastic measures are not done, then no, America won't heal.
Mid-March is the earliest date the third stimulus is likely to be passed. Reduced unemployment benefits from the modest and also last-minute second stimulus package will expire by April. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
What was called a forgotten crisis has once again become front-page news. The brutal war on Yemen, waged by a Saudi-led coalition, aided and abetted by Western powers, in particular the U.S. and the U.K. It's a war that's killed more than 100,000 people, destroyed much of Yemen's infrastructure, and subjected more than 20 million of its population to famine. But last week, an apparent change in policy, an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, announced by U.S. President Joe Biden, received with cautious optimism for its ambiguous wording. Across the Atlantic, a different reaction from the second leading arms supplier to Saudi Arabia. The decision the U.S. takes on matters of arms sales are decisions for the U.S. The U.K. takes its own arms export responsibilities very seriously, and we continue to assess all arms export licenses in accordance with strict licensing criteria. Those campaigning to end the UK weapons exports to Riyadh beg to differ. In 2019, following a case brought by the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, led to a UK court decision banning the sale of UK-made arms to Saudi-led forces over breaches of international humanitarian law. A year later, that ruling was overturned.
Well, they say that all the licenses are double-checked and that actually the weapons that they're selling Saudi Arabia are not being used in the war on Yemen. This is palpably not the case.
Since the bombing of Yemen began in March 2015, the UK has licensed £6.8 billion worth of arms to the Saudi regime, including more than £2.5 billion in the form of aircraft, helicopters and drones, and nearly £4 billion in grenades, bombs, missiles and countermeasures.
I think the figures show just how central Britain is to the ongoing war effort in the Saudi-led coalition. You know, these are huge amounts of offensive weapons that are being sold. And we've even had spokespeople from BAE Systems saying that their involvement, the involvement of this key British company in the war effort, is basically essential to the maintenance of the bombing campaign the Saudis are involved in.
The UK's biggest arms company, BAE Systems, has pocketed £15 billion from services and sales to Saudi Arabia since the Yemen war began.
An end to arms sales alone may not terminate the war in Yemen, but it could be the beginning of the end. Perhaps it's time for the UK government to put its conscience before its arms industry and prevent the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen from escalating any further. Saeed Furiza, London.
Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagheer Ghalibaf visited Moscow for talks with a number of Russian officials on regional and international issues aimed at further cementing the two sides' strategic relations. In a meeting with the chairwoman of Federation Council of Russia, Valentina Matviyenko, Ghalibaf said his visit to Russia has become special since he carries a message from Iran's Islamic Revolution leader Ayatollah Sayed Ali Khamenei to Russian President Vladimir Putin.
This important message is about the region and the world powers and has the meaning that the bilateral relation between Iran and Russia will be strategic and deep for several decades. Iran's leader has also thanked the Russian Federation and China for the fair position on the Iran nuclear deal. Europe and the US did not fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA.
The Iranian official also made it clear that Iran has received nothing from the JCPOA other than sanctions and underlined that Iran will do its best to neutralize unilateral sanctions imposed on the country.
Our goal is to neutralize sanctions, that is, to strengthen our economy through expanding ties with friendly countries that have independence in decision making.
For her part, chairwoman of the Federation Council of Russia said the visit of Ghalibaf would give fresh impetus to the relations between the two states. She also said that Moscow is eager to expand ties with Iran despite obstacles on this way.
Industry, clean energy, counterterrorism, defense, technology, culture are areas of strategy, and this is where Russia and Iran say they can establish cooperation to counter the U.S. unilateralism as well as their culture of dominance.
This visit is intended to help Russia and Iran find a ground for further cooperation. This will help us to stop the global wave of chaos and lawlessness. This will also pave the way for putting an end to the immoral sanctions on Iran and the Russian Federation.
Iranian Parliament Speaker arrived in Moscow on Sunday at the official invitation of Russia's State Duma at the head of a high-ranking parliamentary delegation. During his visit, he held talks with some senior Russian officials, including Secretary of Security Council of Russia Nikolai Patrushev, on a number of regional and international issues, from terrorism to upcoming international meeting on Syria in the Astana format in Sochi. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Iran has officially launched its vaccination program, with the son of Iran's health minister being the first Iranian volunteer to receive the Russian Sputnik V vaccine. Doctors, nurses, and medical workers there received the first doses of Russian vaccine. Speaking at a ceremony at Imam Khomeini Hospital, Iran's health minister said Iran has chosen and imported one of the least harmful and less dangerous vaccines.
We have chosen and imported one of the least harmful and less dangerous vaccines after assessing the most credible vaccines available. Iran insisted from the very beginning that it imports a vaccine only if it has already undertaken the third phase of its human trial, while some of the regional countries did not do so.
In a video address, Iran's president Hassan Rouhani said the vaccination campaign will ensure health of those who receive it.
The fact that the son of the health minister has become a volunteer to receive the first vaccine sends out this message that if officials make decisions about a vaccine and the health ministry approves it, we are all ready to receive it. People should be assured that if a vaccine is imported to the country, all officials trust it. We hope this vaccination campaign will ensure the health of all those who receive imported and domestically made vaccines so that we can take a big step in the fight against COVID-19.
Iran received the first vaccine shipment containing 500,000 doses last week from Russia. It is planned to receive a total of 2 million doses of Sputnik V by the end of March.
The top priority groups of people for vaccination are doctors, nurses, and other medical staff working at intensive care units in hospitals. People over 65 and those with chronic diseases will be amongst the second group of people to be vaccinated. The vaccination of doctors and medical personnel is expected to be complete in less than 2 months.
Iran's vaccination campaign comes as the country is working on its two domestically produced vaccines, namely Covid-1 and Razi-Covpars, which are at the stage of human trials.
According to Iran's health ministry, the national vaccination program in the country will be completed until the end of the next Iranian calendar year. Saman Kujur, Tehran.
In a press conference, Sudan's Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok announced a major cabinet reshuffle, adding that the new cabinet will focus on economic reforms, peace building, balanced foreign policy, destruction of civilian and military entities, and justice for victims of civil wars in the country.
Our government focuses on a number of issues, particularly economy. We have a unified vision in coping with the current economic crisis. We will work hard to implement Juba peace agreement.
The reshuffle is a part of the government's larger plan to push through the reforms and get foreign finance to overcome an ongoing economic crisis. It follows a peace deal signed in October with some rebel groups. Fighting in Darfur has left at least 300,000 people dead and 2.5 million displaced since 2003. Regarding foreign relations, Hamdok said Sudan's relation will be based on mutual interest, adding that most issues, including relations with Israel, will be decided by the next legislative assembly.
We repeat once again that the issue of normalizing ties with Israel will be decided by the upcoming legislative assembly, and it will decide to accept or reject it.
The reshuffle has created mixed reactions among the public, with many expecting new ways to overcome the current problems.
The ministerial reshaping has been overwhelmed by complacencies. The new ministers are activists with no deep experience. Plus comes as the economic situation is very bad.
This government has done nothing. We want a better government that provides us with better services. I'm struggling with poverty and I can't meet my needs.
Sudan's economy was destroyed under previous regime by decades of sanctions, mismanagement and civil war.
Sudan Prime Minister has finally made the long-awaited cabinet reshuffle. But the question is, to what extent the new government will be able to address the chronic economic situation and to improve the living condition of Sudanese people? Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
This
for
is
a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود باعث تو لوت
أتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, we send our peace and blessings upon all the prophets of Allah, subhanahu wa ta'ala, and especially the last of them, Muhammadul Mustafa and his progeny, and those companions who follow their path. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi, and welcome to another program of For a Better Life, here on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the psychological diseases that we might have within us and in our society, the culture that we live in, the modern society with its ideology of modernism and postmodernism, where we are